you used to have to wait for the phone to ring, and if you got a phone call from Paramount or Warner Brothers or Disney, it would make your life, and you'd get a job on a movie, it'd be fantastic. Don't wait for a phone call. That's my advice. Don't wait for the phone to ring. Be authentic to yourself. I would say the job that you're after in life isn't a job as a cameraman or a director or a screenwriter or a grip. The job you're after that you want to pursue is being the best you that you can be. Being an artist is like wandering through a dark cave with a flashlight, and then your batteries go out, and then your pants fall down. So it's a very unusual, unconventional way to live your life. Walt Disney, he had this culture of improving. It can't just be good. There is no good. It has to be great. So, let's look at what we have, and then let's start to rip it apart and make it great. You might feel like you're not worthy and you're alone in that kind of thinking, but boy, are you not alone. Failing and stumbling through some creative process is as natural as walking.
Hey guys, welcome back to The Producer's Cut. So a few months back, Zach and I reached out to a guy by the name of Don Hahn. Now if you're not familiar with the name, Don is an absolute legend. He's a producer over at Disney, and he's the guy behind a truly legendary list of films. I mean, we're talking The Lion King, Beauty and the Beast, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Nightmare Before Christmas, like, etc., etc., etc. This guy has had an incredible career. It's really not every day that you get to have a conversation with the guy who produced some of your fondest childhood memories, but fortunately for us, we reached out to Don and he was generous enough to grant us exactly that opportunity. So we were super stoked of this conversation and I hope you guys enjoy it too. I'm going to get right to it. So without any further ado, here he is, Don Hahn.
Studio, this is Don.
Hey Don, this is James Stewart. I've got Zach Wilson here beside me.
How are you guys?
We're great. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We just wanted to start off by letting you know that this isn't a live broadcast, so no pressure.
So I can curse and use foul language and all that stuff is what you're saying?
Anything you want.
Talk about Donald Trump, anything. Okay, good.
Yeah. And we just want to give you kind of, a bit of a foundation for what we want to be touching on today. We'd really like to go through your career, how you got to where you are now, sort of how you got started. And then we'd like to touch on some of the things that you've learned, some of the advice you can pass on to other people who want to get into the sorts of things that you've done.
Okay.
And we watched all of your interviews and it seems like when they're introducing you, you've been unfailingly humble. But we're just really curious to see how you would introduce yourself to other people.
Wow. That's a great question. Well, I don't know. We'll see. It's always hard. It's hard for you guys probably to introduce yourself to other people.
Then again, we don't have very impressive credentials like Lion King or Beauty and the Beast, so
yeah. Well, that's how I usually do it. That's the easy way is just to say Lion King and Beauty and the Beast. And I think the last 10 years or so, I have a bigger interest in filmmaking and especially documentary filmmaking and narrative, the way it can be used to address social issues and tell stories about artistic heroes and that kind of thing. So I guess what I love most about what I do is telling stories. And, so that's probably what I would categorize myself as.
And you've written a number of books, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I enjoy that. Mainly because I get, I'm finishing one now on mid-century Disney. And it's a chance to talk about some things that maybe I experienced by growing up in Southern California, and literally growing up at Disneyland, it seems. And to say, here's this story about this place that in the post-World War II era was this kind of magical spot where there was tremendous optimism and anything could happen. And it was the home of aerospace and it was the home of NASA and the space program. It was the home of Disneyland and it was the home of all these amazing things. And so I love to share those stories and kind of, try to shine a light on things that maybe I experienced that other people haven't.
Actually, Disney had a bit of an influence on the space program, did they not?
Yeah, they did. Back in the 50s, there was when Walt was just getting into TV, most people don't know all of Disneyland was funded by ABC and to a lesser extent by Western Publishing. But ABC needed television programming really bad because they were the third place network. And so they went to Walt Disney and he was reluctant at first, but he said, well, I'll do it, but I have this idea to build a amusement park, and I want to tie that to the TV show. So ABC gave him money to build Disneyland, and Disneyland is built in sections, And those sections became the weekly series on his TV show. So one week you would go to Frontierland, and one week you would go to Adventureland and take a jungle cruise, and one week you would go to Tomorrowland. And in his Tomorrowland series, he worked with some amazing people from from NASA in predicting decades before the space program ever went to the moon, predicting three-stage rocket launches, predicting travel to Mars. And he worked with Wernher von Braun, who was the head of the NASA space program for a long time, and did this series of predictive television programs that were long and in-depth. And he did shows about physics and atomic energy and never kind of talked down to the audience. He was always very progressive when it came to trusting his audience and believing in them.
That's crazy. It seems like when most people think Disney, they think of Disney Animation or Disneyland, but he seems like he was really quite the Renaissance man.
Yeah, especially after the 40s. You know, he was all about animation in the early part of his life when he was in his 20s. He was making cartoons. In his 30s, he turned a corner into features and made Snow White and Pinocchio and Bambi and Dumbo. And then World War II and a big labor strike that hit his studio kind of discouraged him. And 10 years later, he came back and said, well, let's give it another try. And the thing that was new in that new era of after World War II was diversification. He saw that if he was going to survive as a company, he couldn't just do animation. And so that's when he got into television. That's when he got into publishing, music licensing, theme parks, everything. So that if a movie came out that wasn't that great, they could recoup the money by theme park sales. Or if theme park sales were down, they could have consumer products. Or if that was down, they could have a live-action movie. And that diversification was kind of the beginning of what we think of as a modern media company.
Right, and now Disney's like a huge powerhouse. Like they've got
that's what I've heard.
ESPN,
yeah,
and Marvel. Like they can. It seems like they can basically just print money. I mean,
well, it's a content producer, and that's a simplification of what Disney is. But it is, wisely, I think they've invested not in pipelines or infrastructure or delivery systems. They've invested in what's in those pipelines. So they've invested in creative people and storytelling and people that provide great entertainment. And, it's one thing to say you're going to do that. It's another thing to go to purchase Pixar or Marvel or Lucasfilm and create these hubs of creativity that crank out movies that are not just movies to fill a slate, but they're movies that are really good. And they're movies also that drive a lot of businesses. So if you have a Pixar movie that comes out, it's a movie, but it's also, it's Cars, but it's also Cars Consumer Products, or it's Frozen at Disney, and it's Beauty and the Beast, and it drives, whole areas at the theme park. So that kind of thinking comes from Walt Disney and has been carried on in really spectacular ways by people like Michael Eisner and now Bob Iger into growing those parts of the company in really clever ways. But that thinking really goes back to Walt Disney.
Hey, you've been with Disney for the majority of your career, though,
right? For far too long. No, I have. I have. I started there when I was 20 years old. I was a music student and studied here in Southern California. And but I always loved Disney. You know, it's funny. I grew up with it, and I love drawing, and I love painting, and I love music, and all those things kind of live in Disney for me, and I grew up on the TV show, so I was really lucky, and really, that's the only way I can put it, really lucky to get a job there at a time that was really pivotal when a lot of the old guys were retiring, and I was turning into, just a young guy delivering coffee to them. I was delivering coffee to Ward Kimball and Frank Thomas and, these people who invented the art form of animation. So I was in the right place at the right time and then tried to work hard and gather good groups of people around me to be able to, create movies and produce interesting entertainment. And that's what's been fun. You know, it really is. I realized a long time ago I can't do everything myself. I don't have the patience to sit at a drawing board or sit and edit all day long. And so my attention deficit doesn't allow me to do that. So to be able to hire really gifted people and be able to work with them has been the most rewarding for me.
Did you ever think that you would get to the level you're at now when you were back working on Pete's Dragon at 20 years old?
No. I think I can't even say in my wildest dreams, I never dreamed I'd be doing what I'm doing because I never dreamed this. I never sat there at the age of 12 and said, I want to be a big Hollywood producer. I had no interest in that. I was more going down a path of being a musician. I loved to put on shows. You know, I guess those when I was 5 years old, I loved putting on puppet shows in my sister's window. So I loved that always. But I was a little shy kid and grew up, you know, playing music and putting on shows. So what that turned into, though, was a love of animation, because that's a place where little introverted kids can go and put on shows and work with other people that are like-minded and tell stories and come up with interesting characters. But no, I never sought after things. But I think that's okay. I mean, I'm not sure a 20-year-old or a 25-year-old can look 40 years into the future and say, you know, when I'm 60, I really want to be doing this, because I don't think that's smart even. I think it's much more interesting to take the bends in the river and travel with the river the way it's going, and you'll always run across new people and new things and new opportunities and interesting circumstances that allow you to take twists and turns in your career. And that describes me to a T, is when opportunity came, I could evaluate it and intuitively kind of take something or take a new chance or go in a new direction or not, depending on what that opportunity was. And that was kind of how I navigated my career so far and still am.
How did you get your first job at Disney?
My first job, there was a man who went to my church named Leroy Anderson, and he was in charge of the archives at Disney and the morgue, literally the morgue where they stored all the old animation and all the old artwork. And he needed somebody to come in and work just doing deliveries and inventories and that kind of stuff. So I went to work for him. And it was on the Disney lot in Burbank, so it was a great historic place. And I was surrounded by all this artwork. And then some, you know, the artist would call and say, can you deliver me a scene of drawings or some reference drawings from Jungle Book or 101 Dalmatians or all these movies that I had grown up with. And those were great times, because the studio was a little bit in a holding pattern. People weren't necessarily dashing to see Disney movies in the 70s. Disney Animation was maybe making one movie every 4 years or so. But still, it was these great old men and women who were at the end of their careers, and then a group of new people like Brad Bird and Tim Burton and John Lasseter and Glenn Keane, who were all coming in from CalArts. And so there was a new generation coming in that was two generations removed from the guys that worked with Walt Disney. So you had people in their 20s and people in their 60s. And I think that's what it made it such an interesting time, a really kind of dynamic time, because you had people who had their careers and were still animating. And then you had a young generation that wanted to have their chance. So that's how I started out. And then I moved up into working on Pete's Dragon and you know, being an assistant director and tried animating for a while and those kinds of things.
So what you're telling us is we should go to church to get a job.
That's one way. it is. Well, it's about relationships. You know, it's always about relationships. You know, even now when we put a team of people together to do a movie or hire somebody, you talk to people and you find out who you have a relationship with and who's out there that's interesting that you might know, and you know their sensibilities and their aesthetic and their work ethic, and you're able to hire somebody that fits with you and your family of filmmakers. So yeah, I mean, it's really, I absolutely hate the word networking, because I just hate it. But it's relationships and friendships with people that you can know and trust. Networking implies to me that you're kind of sponging off of other people and just trying to get a wedge in the door any way you can by handing out business cards. That's, you know, nothing wrong with that, I suppose, but better to have some relationships with some mentors that you can have lunch with and trust and get some advice from, and really develop relationships with people that are more than about getting a job, but it's about getting knowledge. And some mentors and some relationships may lead to a job, and that's terrific. But most of the time, we're just trying to get knowledge and input and learn from your colleagues, you know, what it is that you want to do, what's your life's work. So that's the main thing, is develop those relationships, and not just when you're young, but your whole life long.
Who were some of your mentors growing up?
Oh, I was lucky. I had some really good mentors. I worked with a guy named Walt Stanchfield, who was a animator at Disney for years and years, and he was he was almost a bag lady. You know, he lived in his van in the parking lot of Disney. His real home was up in Santa Barbara, north of Santa Barbara, in a Danish American little village called Solvang. He wore shorts all the time. He played tennis. He always had a bag of fruit with him from Whole Foods. And he was just a guy who lived life. And I think that's one of the early lessons I learned is it's not about the job. It's not about the money, although we all have bills and we all need to pay our bills. But it's about living a life and becoming your own self, you know, discovering who you are. And Walt kind of taught me just by example that no matter how unconventional and how eccentric you were, you could be yourself. And that was really empowering because I think when you're young, you're really, our culture somehow teaches us to conform and how to fit into an industrial society, and you have to go to school and you have to go to college and you have to get a salary. And I think what was refreshing about Walt and others like him at Disney was, well, yes, that's all good, but you also have to find out what lights you up and what, you know, turns your creative juices on fire. And that's what a lot of the guys at Disney did. There was another guy named Eric Larson, who was one of the Nine Old Men, great animators for Walt Disney. Same thing. He was an architect before he came to work at Disney. He animated. Some of the other guys I worked with were, you know, fighter pilots in World War II, or Wooly Reitherman, who directed Jungle Book, I worked really closely with. And he was this big cigar-chomping John Wayne kind of guy, and that was his style. And there were other guys that were into Dixieland jazz and buying steam locomotives, and that was their style. So it really opened up this opportunity to live a big life, travel, and have a life much bigger than just being an animator. Animation was just one faction of what these men and women were. They had these big lives, and I think that's been the most inspirational thing to me from those kinds of mentors that I had early on.
You mentioned Wooly Reitherman and how he was like a man's man, and James and I both read your book, Brainstorm, Unleashing Your Creative Self.
Oh, great.
And when you mentioned when you first met him, I really liked the way you put it, that he had an unapologetic approach to art, and how that kind of shifted your view from, you know, this is sort of something I do, to like, no, this is my job and this is, you know, an art form that I'm proud of. How important do you think that is for young people who plan on going into creative fields, to, you know, it's like a screenplay you're working on at Starbucks, to, you know, like, no, I'm a screenwriter or I'm a painter or whatever. How important is that to really own what you're doing?
Well, I think it's really important. And what it taught me working with the people I worked with, whether it was in that early time I was at Disney or even years later when I was working with people like Howard Ashman or Sting or, you know, just people later in my career, there's a preconceived notion about what an artist is, and it's a stereotype. It's an artist isn't somebody who wears a beret and a striped shirt and paints with a palette. You know, one in a million might be, but an artist is somebody who wants to express their creativity in any number of dozens of ways. And those ways have nothing to do with gender or image or preconceived notions about what an artist is. So I think when you're young and starting out, there may even be pressure, certainly within your family or circle of friends, of like, first of all, why do you want to be an artist? You certainly should have something to fall back on. So learn how to do accounting, and learn how to do something that will fit into culture. Well, I feel like that's so wrongheaded. I feel like if you define the arts in a really big way, everything you touch and see and interact with is designed by an artist, from the landscape in Central Park to the watch on your hand, to the computer we stare into all day, to the book you read, to the car you drive, to the clothes you wear, has been designed by an artist. So an artist is really a fundamental, central part of our universe as human beings. And because of that, artists are not, you know, there's no definition for it in terms of artists are really masculine or they're really feminine, or all artists are, you know, incredibly gay, or they're incredibly, they love, you know, Broadway music or something like that. It's like, yes, they do, and their sexuality doesn't really mean a whole heck of a lot when it comes to what they want to create. What's important is that they create something that's unique to them and individual to them and shows the world what they see in life. And so I think that's the job, and that's a scary job, because I have tremendous respect for accountants and lawyers and people that do fit really nicely into society, and those are known quantities, and you can get a degree and kind of move through those in a very respectful way. being an artist is like wandering through a dark cave with a flashlight, and then your batteries go out, and then your pants fall down. So it's, you know, it's a very unusual, unconventional way to live your life. But it's incredibly exciting too, I think. And it's a journey of self-discovery, because you're always trying to say, well, here's how I see the world. How do you see the world? So I'm always going to museums and films and places where I can see how other people see the world. And I'm constantly fighting with myself going, well, how do I see the world? And I think that kind of inner monologue is what artists try to arrive at. So whether you're throwing pots or making a film or writing a novel, you're trying to express yourself and tell the world what you see and what your point of view is. And that's daunting. And yes, there are learned things you can do. It's an art and a craft. So the art of it is that self-expression part. The craft is you have to learn. You have to learn the craft of filmmaking. You have to learn the craft of how to light a set, how to act, how to cut a movie, how to write a script. Those are crafts that are teachable and learnable, and you have to do that. And then the art of it is not so teachable. It's what you bring to the party.
What do you think makes the difference between a hobbyist and a professional artist?
It's a great question. I think a hobbyist, if you take money out of the equation, because you have to, I think the professional artist has to have an obsession about what he or she does. And by that I mean it's so in your under your skin that you can't not do it. And so that might mean model railroading or playing the guitar or animating or whatever, but that obsession about what you do has to be part of it. And there's many people out there who are artists who are in spirit professionals who go home at night and write screenplays till 3 a.m, but have to be a barista during the day to pay the bills. That's a professional artist. And I think mentally you have to kind of screw your head on tight enough to say, my profession is a screenwriter, even though I'm not making a dime at it. My profession isn't being a barista. That's my my avocation. I'm making money doing that, and that's legitimate and something we all do. But the real art is what you might be doing at 3 a.m. So there's that. And then I think true professionals have done their homework. True professionals are deeply studied and educated, whether formally at a university or whether educating themselves on the craft. So let's say you're a songwriter like Howard Ashman. I'm doing a documentary on Howard Ashman right now, the lyricist from Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. And he, he studied at university, and then he went to Indiana University and had his master's degree in theater. And so when he was writing songs for Beauty and the Beast, he could quote chapter and verse from, Broadway shows like The King and I, or Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and just say, okay, it's, that character in Gypsy, it's like that character except like this. And so he had a tremendous catalog of references in his head, and he had tremendous schooling in the craft, so much so that it just became natural to him. It's like being a baseball player or a golfer, and you go out and you hit a million golf balls, and pretty soon you'll get pretty good at hitting golf balls. So you can't expect to be a professional artist or a much less a successful artist by saying, I was born with a little talent and I draw once in a while. Yes, that's good. But I think the thing that people don't see is the hard work and the hours that people put into it. So you don't see, if you see a great baseball player, you don't see the million baseballs he hit. If you see a great artist, you don't see the million drawings that went into the trash can. You just see the couple of good drawings. I've always loved gallery shows or art shows where they show Monet's paintings, but they'll show like the really crappy paintings he did when he was a kid, and you go, oh, well, he started out like I did, and you can realize he's just a human being, and he had, he put his pants on one leg at a time in the morning. But what you don't see is the hours and hours and hours and hours of trial and error and failure and study that somebody like that puts in to their craft. And that's another big part of the commitment and the obsession with what you're doing.
It seems like that happens on a number of different levels, like with, I know especially at Pixar, and I'm assuming at Disney too, the films when they're starting out look nothing like the finished film.
Yeah.
And it requires a lot of nurturing and a lot of caring to be able to sort of push that film along to become what it's going to become.
Yeah.
What does that process look like?
Well, it's, it may or may not be surprising to your listeners, but the first time you see a film, whether it's a Lion King or a Cars or Up or any film, it's pretty awful. And that's because you're getting your raw ideas down on paper, up on the screen, and that applies to writing novels or to, I'm a painter and I do paintings, and my studio is filled with kind of half-done, awful paintings because I'm searching. And that's what filmmaking is. You're searching and you're trying to put up ideas. So you write a script and you write it, create a roadmap, and then you set off on this journey and you put up those pictures and look at it and you go, wow, here's 3 things that work and here's 10 things that don't work. And then you start changing those 10 things that don't work, and all of a sudden the 3 things that worked don't work anymore. So you have to change those too. So it takes maybe 5 or 6 times of putting the entire movie up in different versions to start to say, okay, here's a character that's risen to the top. In Lion King long ago, the character of Rafiki was just a friend of Mufasa's, and he was boring. And in the early screenings, he really wasn't much of anything. And he started to become more interesting when we thought of him as this kind of kooky homeless guy who came in and seemed a little crazy, but had this tremendous wisdom about him. And that started to be an interesting character. And then we added more of him and more of him until he became the shaman of the movie. So that's the kind of discovery that happens by iterating. And it's part of the reason why animated films, by and large, are better than live-action films in many cases. And certainly these days, animated films take up the top end of the box office spectrum. It's because you can iterate and because you can go back and revisit things and change things. And the actors are, computer models or drawings, and they're always there in their trailers. And the sets are always built, so you can go back at the 11th hour and change things and add lines and plus things. And that's a real Walt Disney thing, too. I mean, he had this culture of improving. He called it plussing in the studio all through his life, which was, it can't just be good. There is no good. It has to be great. Let's look at what we have, and then let's start to rip it apart and make it great. So that culture within a studio, whether it's a studio of 3 people or a studio of 3,000 people, has to be there to not just turn out a product and say, okay, we're done and here's your product, but to make that product something special. And I think that's why Disney excels right now, because they do that.
Looking at the difference between animation and live action, you clearly have a lot more control with animation, but you do have to create everything that you see in those worlds. So having the ability to do anything, is it a bit of a burden to have to come up with anything and to be able to do anything and have to decide what you're not going to do and not have sort of the spontaneity that you can get when you're shooting live action?
Yeah, I mean, that's the test in animation, is you do have complete control, and that's a blessing and a curse. In a live action film, you can get Emma Watson to be in front of the camera, and she brings a tremendous amount to the movie. And you also get, like in Beauty and the Beast, you get Josh Gad doing a character. Well, you're going to get great improvisation and little asides and looks and things that you may not get from another actor. You get all the same things in animation, though. Animators are actors with that are just holding a keyboard and a mouse instead. And you're getting all the same kinds of things. It's just a little more deliberate, a little more planned. And you're getting the individuality of the animator and the individuality of that performance on the screen. But you're just having to slow down and do it at a really ridiculously slow rate to be able to create that performance. And that's the really good animated films make you forget that you're looking at pixels and pencils, and you just believe that they're characters. And that's the art, where the art comes in, is that you feel like you're really looking at a character, and you start to root for that character and have happiness and sadness for that character. And that's where those characters coming to life is really what makes animation kind of magical. So also the artifice in animation, the ability to draw anything and stylize it and use colors in their heightened form and use music is another kind of part of it that I love, because you can, manipulate is too strong of a word, but you can steer the audience's emotions in a number of directions in a really quick and effective way, in a way that can be a little harder in live action. It can be done in live action for sure, but in animation you have total control over how you kind of corral the audience's emotions and steer them in the right direction.
In your book, Brainstorm, you talk a lot about improvisation and how that can actually be a very good tool as for a creator. As a producer who needs to make sure that the project actually gets made and finished and hopefully on budget and on schedule, how do you actually plan for improvisation to be part of the process without it getting out of hand?
Well, you literally do plan for it. You plan either for retakes and reshoots if it's a live-action film, or for enough time for the movie to fall apart if it's an animated film. So if if it takes 6 weeks to put an animated film up on story reels and look at it, let's say, the first time it goes up, it's not going to be great. So you add another iteration, and that's going to be 12 weeks. And let's say it takes five times to do that, you're going to add 30 weeks. So you have, 30 weeks to put the movie up five times, and you plan for that failure. And that's not a hard thing to do, really. So it's debatable, and you have to often convince investors that that's part of the process, because there might be people who think, well, you write a script, and isn't that like a blueprint, and can't you just build from the blueprint? And the answer is yes, but it's not always functional if you build from that blueprint literally. So just like if you were building a house, sometimes you want to walk through and say, well, I know we put the door here on the drawing, but I think the door would work better now over here now that I see it. So you have to be willing to make those changes on the fly and plan for that amount of time to make those changes. And that's the luxury that studios like Disney have that many studios don't. If you're working with a micro budget on a film, whether it's a documentary or a live action or animated film, you may not have a lot of time to do that. So you have to be very clever and very resourceful to say to your investors, whether those are an outside corporation or whether it's your grandmother giving you the money, you have to say, I'm going to cut this movie together, and I promise you it'll suck the first time I cut it together. So I'm going to allow myself a couple more times to polish it, show it to friends, get some feedback, and make it as good as it can be. And that's going to be part of my plan. So you have to just plan into it the inevitability of failure and the inevitability of chaos, because there's kind of this myth of control that we have. And we do have a lot of control, but there's also accidentals that crop up. And if you're halfway through a movie and somebody has a great idea, you can't say, no, I'm sorry, that's not in the script. We can't do that great idea. Some people do, to their peril, but you want to be able to say, oh, that's spectacular, because if we did that, we could do this, and kind of build on those great ideas and be able to make something better than the original plan was. So planning for improvisation, planning for failure, that kind of thing is really doable. It's a little scary sometimes for people who are investing time and money, but you're really investing, again, in great, great product, and you have to turn out something great. You need to iterate, and to iterate, you need to fail. So you have to just plan that into the process. How many times to plan that? That's a negotiation. That's saying, well, grandma only has $5,000 to give me, so that means I can put the movie together twice, and that's it. But that's twice. That's good. Or if you're a major studio, you might be able to put it together 6 times or 10 times. Every time you put it together, you're going to see improvements and see new ideas come up, and that's kind of the goal, is to allow yourself to plan for those accidents and iterations as you go.
You talk about planning to fail, and that reminds me of a great quote in your book that you use, which is, fail fast, fail often. Do you know if young artists, creators, writers, whatever they may be, do they know that it's okay to fail? Is it something that might not be something that people are just initially okay with, to reach those 10,000 hours of work to be a professional at something?
Failing is so part of the process. And I think sometimes when you're younger, you feel like you're the only one. And sometimes it surprises people when I say, no, I fail on a daily basis in a miserable way. Even today, it's not like Don Hahn gets some special ceremony with the gods and gets these wonderful ideas that happen into movies. It's not that way at all. Oh my God, it's not that way at all. You just try to put together the elements that create something interesting, and then you go with the flow. And I don't even look at things as failures necessarily. They are challenges. There's hurdles. There's fences to get over. Some days you win and have really cool things happen. Other days are disappointing. But failure is kind of a strong word to say. That failure almost sounds like it's fatalistic. You can't recover from it. And in the arts, I think you can almost always recover from failure. In some cases, a failure comes from outside. It might be, maybe you're suffering from a disease, or maybe you're suffering from, there's no money to create your art. Well, those aren't failures. Those are circumstances. And you can always find a way around those things. There's many stories about, you know, people without the resources to create great art through their painting or dance or filmmaking. So you just have to look at those things as challenges. You also have to look at them as inevitable. There doesn't exist a human being without flaws and failures. And if you're younger coming up, you might feel like you're not worthy and you're alone in that kind of thinking. But boy, are you not alone. The only difference between me at 20 and me at 60 is I hide my failures really well. So I trip and fall and, you know, creatively damage myself every day. I just hide it well. It's okay to just say, wow, I really screwed up today. And then pretend that everything is okay. I think when you're younger, you seem just more vulnerable because you're feeling like I need to look for a job. I need to support myself. I need to make my parents happy. And those are all good, but you also need to realize that failing and stumbling through some creative process is as natural as walking. And that stumbling means you're actually going in a good direction. If you have a project or work with people who are confidently succeeding at every step, that's something to run from, I think, because it's basically saying, I know what I'm doing, I know what I want, and I'm right. I don't know of anybody that thinks that way that's particularly interesting. They may be successful even. They may even be able to produce products or film or whatever. But that idea that I'm right and you're not is not something for the arts. The arts are to be debated and discovered and expressed. And it's fine to say I'm right when it comes to expressing myself, and here's my version of what life looks like through my eyeballs. That's definitively right. That's authentic. But the collaboration and the way we arrive at our art is clumsy, chaotic, improvisational, all those things, and that's okay.
It seems like a lot of people like to kind of fall into that trap of thinking that people are either creative or they're not, and that it's like an inborn quality that they're going to have.
Yeah.
Versus requiring years and years of developing. Do you think that people underestimate how long it's going to take to develop into the creative professional they're going to become, and then either like short circuit their learning process or just drop out completely?
No, that's a really good point. I think that's absolutely right, because I always tell people, if you know, to be a really good functioning artist, it's going to take as long as it's going to take to be a really good functioning surgeon. So, you know, give yourself 10 years after you get out of school to kind of have life experiences. There's a great, I love the term for your 20s. A lot of psychologists are calling it the Odyssey years now, because those Odyssey years are about discovering who you are, who your life mate is in many cases, what the soil is you're going to grow from, what your life's work is, what your individual ethics and aesthetics are separate from your parents. So those years in your 20s, you're discovering all those things, and you're going to have some breakthroughs. You're going to create some great things, but you're also going to create some mediocre things. And the judgment of those things is not up to you. The judgment is not up to finances. You know, if you sell a painting for $1 million tomorrow, that's fantastic, but I'm not sure how that relates to your creative journey. It'll finance a great studio and you can buy some more paints and things, but the journey has to keep going, and then you're probably going to create a lot of paintings that nobody wants. So the judge of what you do is not up to you. What is up to you is to just create a lot of stuff and create things that are authentic to you. And if you do that, then over a period of time, you'll end up with a body of work that is unmistakably authentic. And a lot of times, like when I was painting as a younger man, I worried that I didn't have a style. I thought, I don't have a style. I don't have a signature. I look at other painters, and they're so unique, and they're so bold visually. And now after painting for 30 or 40 years, I look at my stuff, and I may like it or not, but I have a style that's as unique as my handwriting, that's as unique as the way I comb my hair and dress. So my handwriting is really there and visible, but that just comes through the pencil mileage and shoe leather of doing it. And that applies to almost any craft, from being a filmmaker to being a potter to being a painter to being a dancer, is you have to do it. And the best screenwriters I know are the ones that write all the time. The best dancers I know are the ones that dance all the time. And aren't after, any, they're dancing and writing because they have to. They're obsessed with it and they have no other choice in their life. And they make a living by it or not, but that's their obsession in life. So, you know, when you're young, I think you just have to stick to that. Is there such a thing as talent? Yeah, I call it by the fancy word of kind of propensity. You know, you have a bent towards something in your life. Some people can hit a fastball and hit it out of the park, and that's kind of a gift. Their hand-eye coordination is really special. Some people can hold a pencil and draw, but that alone is nothing. That's, you know, 1% of the process. It's the work that goes after that. It's the million baseballs you hit. It's the million drawings you do that start to turn you into a more interesting artist.
There's one thing that I've noticed happening that kind of makes me suspicious of some people when they say, I want to be an actor, but they've never acted, or I want to be a writer, but they haven't written a script before. You mentioned how every few years you sort of like audit yourself and look at, okay, what am I doing? And is this what I want to be doing? And where is this going to take me? Do you think that having that kind of self-awareness is something that a lot of people tend to lack?
Well, there's no motivation to do that. Nobody's coming in, if it's your employer or your spouse is coming in and saying, you know, Don, I really think you should reevaluate your life right now. And if you do, there's some incentives for you. Here's some cash and a new car. Just reevaluate your life right now. Nobody does that in our lives. There's more incentive and gravitational force to stay the same. So if you're making a good salary and you're reasonably happy in your relationship and in your work, that's happiness until something comes in from the outside and blows that apart. You probably will reach the end of your life and just keep doing that, even if you start to atrophy a little bit and become unhappy with that. So you have to really poke yourself and reevaluate yourself. If you're in a work environment, the HR department will come in and do a job evaluation and say, you know, Don, you really screwed up this last year and you were late to work and we really think you need to improve. So it'll come from the outside far. And I can't stand that. I can't stand anybody evaluating me. Because I'm thin-skinned. So what I rather do is evaluate myself first and just say, okay, if I'm looking at myself from the outside, I can say, Don, you're really lazy about these things. You're really resourceful about these things. But you really need to work on these things over here and be truthful with yourself and have that really uncomfortable conversation that's unmotivated by the outside or anybody else. It's just a conversation with yourself. And I know a lot of really interesting people who go take a week every year and I have a good friend that goes to a cabin in Maine every year for a week. Bill Gates goes to a place for a week and has a retreat. People go out to the desert, whatever, and just have that moment of reflection, whether you just, you know, and talk about where you're at and what you want to do and what, you know, do you have some childhood dreams that are unfulfilled or childhood dreams that are obsolete? You know, there's you're not the same person at 30 that you were at 20. So if you want to be a animator at 20 and thought that was the greatest thing in the world, and now you're 30 and you'd rather go into graphic design or you'd rather go into accounting, that's okay. I mean, that's the journey. So to do those reevaluations at different points along the line is really important. It's just there's nobody in life that will tell you to do that. So you have to stand up and do it yourself. And it can be unpleasant. You know, there's going to be good and bad when you do that. And it's just important to do that.
It can be a really uncomfortable conversation to have with yourself. I know that, especially with the entertainment industry, we tend to idealize it and mythologize it. Like the way people look at the stars and all about the business in general. How do you think a young person might be able to tell if their desire to go into that field is based on an actual love of the work itself, or just on sort of an idea of what they want to accomplish down the road, like being a movie star, being a famous writer, something but that's not real. It's based on
status,
based on a lot of, well, looking at it through rose-colored glasses.
Yeah. Well, let's take the fame out of it for a second, because that is something, it's kind of another aspect of it, but just take kind of the craft and the pursuing a particular art form. If you wake up in the morning and just have to do this thing, that's a pretty good sign. If you wake up in the morning and say, I really want to be a star and be an actor, but like I talk to a lot of people that want to be screenwriters, and I ask them, have they written short stories or have they taken some classes? Or, well, no, I haven't, but I'm thinking about doing a screenplay about such and such. That's not a good sign. If you are of a certain age and have written a lot of screenplays, whether they get produced or not is one thing, but you love the art form. You love considering every phrase and every word. You love turning words around in your head. You love coming up, like Stephen King talks about, coming up with a perfect first sentence in a novel and working on that for months on end. If you love that, and if you read a lot of screenplays and watch a lot of movies and you find that's your passion in life, that's a pretty good sign to follow that. But if you just feel like, oh man, I'd really like to be a star, people don't see the work that those people put in. If you're an actor who has had some longevity in the industry, those people work really hard at what they do. They study movies. I remember working with Eddie Murphy a long time ago, and he would look at two or three movies a day of leading male actors from the entire history of filmmaking and try to learn from them. So he would just study. It's part of it. So if you find yourself doing that, that's all a pretty good sign. The fame part of it, like being successful and famous, is uncalculable. There are a million ways to do that. The way that I like, I don't necessarily aspire to be famous or don't want to. What I aspire to is to create work that is great, that people have to pay attention to it. So whether it's a small documentary that's made for $3 or whether it's a $100 million movie, you want to do work that is so good that people pay attention to it. Steve Martin said that in his biography, that he wanted to get so good at his stand-up that people couldn't not respond to him. And I think that's really the goal. And then whether they do or not is not up to you. Some people may, so you might become a star, but there's so many kinds of celebrity. There's kind of the Kardashian kind of celebrity, which is almost a purchased kind of celebrity that is not based on skills or a particular kind of work, but it's based on scandals and interesting people. Much better to base it on the work and let your work be the celebrity as opposed to you. And I think that's a little more authentic, to say, I want my books to be the heroes of my life. I want my films to be the heroes of my life and the celebrities. Then you'll find yourself putting your resources into those things as opposed to putting them into your ego.
One thing that I thought was particularly interesting was how you said that The Lion King was not expected to be a huge hit.
Right.
Yeah. What was the film at the time?
Pocahontas was going on at the time.
Pocahontas, right.
And Pocahontas is a great movie. I love that movie, and it turned out to be a really good film. But they started about the same time, and I couldn't get anybody to work on Lion King because I would say it's a story about a young lion cub who gets framed for murder by his uncle and grows up with a warthog and a flatulent warthog out in the wilderness and comes back to claim his throne. It's loosely based on the story of Hamlet and Joseph from the Bible, and it's got music by Elton John. And people would just go, well, good luck with that, and then just would kind of run out of the room. But we ended up getting a group of people on that film that really were devoted to it and really saw it as an opportunity. So not every movie and not every story will sound great. And Ed Catmull at Pixar talks about this. He said you kind of have a choice of saying, can you find a terrific idea for a movie and make it with mediocre people? Or can you find an okay idea for a movie and great people will make that okay idea great? And I always sign up to the second version of that, which is, there are no great ideas for movies. The pitch for Lion King, it was as bad as the pitch for movies like Ratatouille. It's like, a rat dreams of cooking. Who would ever make that movie? But Brad Bird turned that into something that was really unique. Or like Lilo and Stitch, little girl adopts a space alien in Hawaii. It's like the worst idea ever for a movie, but those guys turned that into a really interesting film. So great people in a collaborative spirit can make a mediocre idea work. And mediocre people with a great idea can pull it down and turn it into something that's not so great. So for me as a producer, it's always trying to create those rooms full of people that are safe rooms where you can say anything without fear of being derided, and then trying to give those great people space to do their work.
You mentioned in your book how important it is to have a brain trust. And I really liked how you phrased it, to have someone who can creatively return your serve. Just how vital is it and how important is it to have someone who can really honestly bounce your ideas back off of you?
Well, it's crucial because there's plenty of people, and you need them too, that will say you're so good. You are just so talented and good. And that always makes me cringe a little bit, even today. It's like, don't say that. because you need that, your ego needs that, but far more valuable is a good friend or a good mentor that'll say, you know, your work is good, but it would be better if you did A, B, and C. And this scene is good or this painting is good. Like, I work with a painting teacher, and he'll look at my painting, and I'll think I'm showing him something pretty good. This happened at Disney, too, when I was working with Walt Stansfield, my mentor. I would take him a drawing and go, this is a great drawing. He's going to love this. And the minute he put it on his desk, he put a fresh piece of paper over the top and said, well, you know, if you just straightened the neck a little bit and made the fur do this, and if you did this, and suddenly my drawing was awful, and he would show me how to make it better. So we don't always see clearly just through our own eyes. We see clearest through multiple eyes with multiple brains. So the more you can build that brain trust, and that doesn't have to be friends and family. It can be people who are willing to give you a little time, a teacher, a mentor. In college, it can be fellow classmates are terrific for that. They'll be honest with you. And you may not like what they say. You may not agree with what they say, and you don't have to do what they say. But to get that honest feedback is really important. So when we finish a movie, we're like the Howard Ashman documentary we work on, we're going to get in a small room full of people, trusted colleagues. We're going to look at it, and they're going to shoot holes in it, and they're going to say things that I cringe at and go, well, I can't do that. But it'll give us great feedback, and it'll give us some fresh eyes on the project. And that's so important in your life, no matter what you do as an artist, is to have those eyes. And that might be a family member, might be a parent, but it's just as easily going to be a mentor or somebody out there in the world, you know, that can give you just a straight scoop about your work.
This idea of the brain trust, was this in use at Disney before before Pixar was bought by Disney?
Yes and no. I think the difference between Pixar and Walt Disney is Walt Disney himself. Walt Disney was the brain trust in many ways, so the buck stopped with him. But his biggest success, and he would say so, is putting together an organization of men and women who could do this work. And the work was, if you take somebody like Mark Davis, who was one of his lead animators who animated Cruella de Vil and Maleficent and so many great characters, he also designed Pirates of the Caribbean and a lot of the Haunted Mansion. And so Walt could come in and say, hey, you know, I have this idea to build an attraction with dolls in costumes of the world, and it's called It's a Small World. And they would do it. They didn't know what was going to happen when they came into work in the morning. But his team of people were can-do kind of people. And it was a small team, and they could do anything he asked for. So he had his brain trust in his team of people, and then he could guide them with what happened. So the brain trust at Disney kind of takes the place of Walt himself, because there is no Walt Disney figure anymore to do that. So the brain trust of amazing people can sit down and say, you know, as a group, there's a flaw here. We can see this. We can throw out ideas and help each other make our movies as good as they can be. And that brain trust extends beyond creative issues, too. I mean, we have consultants and people we work with that are lawyers and accountants and, you know, marketeers and publicists that are our brain trust in a number of different areas. That help us evaluate our lives with fresh eyes from the outside, because it's hard for us to see ourselves. So to have somebody look at a drawing and say, it's a good drawing, but it would be better if you did that, is really what the brain trust comes from. Walt Disney could sure do that. He was writing the checks, and so he was kind of the final word on things, and the brain trust really is a collective group now that takes that place.
Are you able to tell? You talk a lot about separating the rocks from the gems. And when you're nurturing a new project and you're sort of seeing what it can develop into, is there ever a point where you look at it and you're like, this just isn't going to become anything, and then you toss it aside? How do you determine what's a worthy project and what might not be?
Yeah, it happens once in a while. It happens, you know, on smaller artistic endeavors like a painting or something like that. It's pretty easy to work on something for a day and toss it aside that it's not working. It's a little harder to work on something for a year and toss it aside. But that happens too. And it's, you know, it's like romance. You can work on a relationship for a year and it starts out great and looks like it's going to be terrific. And after a year, it's like, you know what, this isn't working out. We're going to have to break up. And it's exactly like that. The love that you have and the starry-eyed romance that starts out on a project runs into the harsh reality of life at a certain point, and it either survives that or it doesn't. I think a clever group of people can turn almost anything into a surviving project, but sometimes it's best to cut bait and move on. Luckily, in my life, we've mostly been able to hang in there, but on every project, virtually every project I've worked on, there's been that cut bait moment. On Beating the Beast, we put it together for the first time, looked at the first 20 minutes, and our executives just said, let's stop. Just stop right now. It's awful. It's like an animated masterpiece theater. This is never going to work. And so we had to stop and then retrench. We brought in Howard Ashman. We brought in Kirk Wise and Gary Trousdale, the new directors, and started over again. So sometimes it's the same project, but hitting a restart button. The same was true with Wreck-It Ralph. We started out with a project called Joe Jump that was about a character in a video game, and that fell by the wayside and it got reinvented as Wreck-It Ralph. So there's always these false starts on projects, always. So sometimes you can resurrect those out of the rubble, and sometimes you can't, but most of the time they come back. The most extreme example of that is Emperor's New Groove, which has become this kind of cult comedy from Disney Animation. It fell apart. We changed directors. It was more of a serious animated film. It became this kind of wacky comedy, and now it's this beloved cult film from the 90s. So,
one thing I've noticed is that, when I go onto Facebook or something, there's a lot of people being vocal about Disney dipping into their collection of past stories, and they seem to assume that this is, Disney's running out of ideas, but they have no context for how those decisions are made to remake something.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that they're not hastily made decisions. Like, didn't Maleficent take about 7 years to make?
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
There's no easy answer to this. There is no Disney. Disney is people. So Disney is, a group of executives and people that sit in rooms and agonize over these things. Movies are expensive. Marketing movies is even more expensive. So when you make a movie, you want to have some sort of audience awareness in the best of cases when you're starting out. So Marvel does that really well. They have people that are comic fans, people that know who Iron Man is, and they'll go see an Iron Man movie. Star Wars has become that. Some animation movies are that way, although nobody has ever heard of Frozen. Nobody's ever heard of, Up or Inside Out, and those become huge hits. So there's the creation of new material that can happen, but it's also completely legitimate to say, let's retell this story again. Let's revisit some material and do it in a way that's more relevant to our culture right now. So when you say, let's go remake Beauty and the Beast, I think to some people that sounded like a sketchy idea, because there was nothing wrong with the original movie. But to come back and say, well, let's tell it with somebody like Emma Watson, let's get Bill Condon to direct it, let's reimagine it in a live-action world in ways that they didn't in the animated film. And you know what? At the end of the day, the animated film is still there and full of life and never going to go away, and now so is the live-action film. So if it was done in a shoddy manner or kind of a, slap it together manner, then that's a cash grab and everybody smells that. But when it's done at the highest level of quality and done with the intent of reimagining a story for the current generation in a way that's valid and relevant, that's not a cash grab. That's storytelling, and that's what our job is. Our job in life is to retell the great stories of all time in a way that's relevant to today's audience and show people what it's like to be alive in 2017, not in 1991. So if you want to know what it was like to be alive in 1991, go look at that movie. If you want to see what it's like to be alive today, go look at the new movie. And that's what storytellers do. Beauty and the Beast has been told on film probably 12 or 13 times. Before that, it was told in mythology and fairy tales like Cupid and Psyche and Hunchback of Notre Dame and Cyrano. And it's an old story. And so to retell it again is really logical. And the same with Little Mermaid, and the same with a lot of the films that are coming out now from Disney.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny that you mentioned that, because it seems like everyone's so focused on telling a new story nowadays, and I'm sure most of the time they don't even realize that they're most likely retelling an older story. But is it more important to just make sure the story is good, even if it's been done before? Or is it... do you think maybe people are putting too much emphasis on, it's just got to be new, it doesn't matter if it's good, it just needs to be something we haven't seen before?
Well, I think when you go to the theater to see a movie, you don't carry a score sheet with you that says, well, this isn't as good as the last version of that movie, or this isn't as good as the fairy tale, or whatever. I think audiences, at least for 10 or 15 minutes, are really willing to suspend their disbelief and give the filmmakers a lot of credit and let the filmmakers go where they want to go. You know, one example of that comes to mind is Moulin Rouge, the Baz Luhrmann film from a few years ago. It was an incredibly crazy, visionary thing that none of us would have done, but he did, and it was brilliant. So the audience goes in not knowing what to expect, and they get swept away. That's the ideal. So yeah, you want to make a good movie, and everyone in Hollywood starts out wanting to make a good movie. Nobody starts out saying, I'm going to do something really mediocre. So you want to kind of hit the high bar when you set out to do that. And then a lot of variables take place, and some of those are time and money, some of those are talent and actors, some of those are writing and story, and you have to surf through all those variables to try to get your movie to the screen in the most successful way that you can. So, the stories have a lot in common, and, you know, if you go see Fast and Furious, it's going to have a lot of amazing new things in it. But it's also going to have a lot of things that are common, and you're, as an audience member, kind of happy that it has some things that are foundations that you can stand on. So it's not just this esoteric exploration of car chases. There's actually some story and foundation work and characters that you can get into. And then, yes, you'll have all the kind of wonderful adrenaline-pumping car chases on top of that. So it's an inexact science. That's all I can say. Like most things in life, it's an inexact science.
And it's funny that you mentioned Baz Luhrmann, because he also made Romeo and Juliet and The Great Gatsby, which are two very old stories that everybody knows, but he found a new way to tell them that made them, like you said, relevant again. And for, especially for younger audiences who, you know, I know a lot of people, maybe my little sister, seeing Christopher Reeve flying around as Superman, not quite as believable with the effects that we have now today that she might rather see.
Yeah, it's true. And that just goes back to the idea of retelling stories in a relevant way. And so those movies from Baz Luhrmann are revolutionary that way. And you know, Christopher Nolan, there's a bunch of filmmakers out there, dozens of them, in fact, that are doing the same thing. And those are the exciting filmmakers.
There's the obvious tension in the industry of it being sort of the intersection of art and commerce, but it seems like the animation studios have been able to handle that better than a lot of the other live-action studios.
Mm-hmm.
How do you navigate that dilemma of the financial realities with the creative ideals, and why do you think animation might be able to handle that better than live action?
The financial realities are always there. It's not that they're hidden, but I don't think the audience goes to the theater with a need to understand the finances of it. That's changed a lot in the last 25 years. I think post internet era, nobody went to see Ben-Hur or Sound of Music and cared about the opening weekend box office. Now, you know, Ghost in the Shell comes out and doesn't quite perform, and it's a news item. That would never happen 40, 50 years ago. So there is an element of that just because of the ease of communication right now. In animation, the finances are, I won't say that they're boring, but they're somewhat steady. A movie from Pixar or Disney or DreamWorks, they're round about the same budget. So it's not like one movie's suddenly out of control budget-wise and the next one isn't. They are high-labor movies, and they have a certain kind of expectation in terms of their budget. So there's not a lot of budget stories out there in animation. I think that's part of it. Nobody's paying $25 million to get a certain actor to appear in their animated film. So you don't get those big headline kind of stories that you might in a live action film. And I think that's what makes it, that's what keeps it out of the news and keeps it out of the headlines.
Yeah. Plus I guess you have a much larger audience with a G rating. Are family movies a much, smaller, well, like a much larger market with a smaller amount of competition than say PG-13?
They are true G movies are almost become toddler movies or really young movies these days, and PG-13 movies are mostly the norm for even for animation, and that's changed over the last 25 years. Lion King, as intense as that is, and Lion King is a pretty intense movie, that was a G-rated movie back then. So they're both successful. Family movies are incredibly successful, largely because they're easily exportable internationally. so you can have some, you know, a film that can be told to the whole audience, and it doesn't have to be censored or limited, doesn't have to limit your audience as it goes around the world. So family movies is incredibly competitive. It's not that it's less competitive, it's more competitive these days in that G, PG, and PG-13 space. So you have to be really good to be competitive and get a piece of the box office. And then you also have to market them really well.
I'm taking the scale down a bit from massive blockbusters to just the personal aspect of creativity. A quote that you used a few times in Brainstorm, which I really liked, was impression without expression equals depression. Could you explain what that means?
Yeah, that quote comes from Walt Stanchfield that we talked about a little bit ago. He said that, and it just clicked in my mind and many other people who studied with him. And it's the simple act of saying life is full of all these impressions of not just visual, but just emotional impressions. You know, it's you know, whether it's art that you see or music that you hear or the election cycle you've been through or whatever, you have these emotional hits, whether good or bad, on those things. And you need to express them somehow. That can be expression through talking to a psychotherapist. That can be expression through painting, through making a film, through telling a story. And that expression helps us vent our feelings and, more importantly, put our feelings into perspective so that we can understand the tragedies and triumphs of life more if we express those and look at them. If we internalize them, it tends to fester and not go to a good place. But if we can put our impressions in life into expressions of art, then we can look at them and externalize them and look at them dispassionately to a degree, as an artifact of that time. And Picasso used to sign but also date his paintings because he felt like his paintings were diary entries, almost. So those were just a diary of how he felt on that day. And I think a lot of times our art is that way. So you can look at the expressions of our life, however you express yourself. Some people may do it through sports, through softball, through golf, through dance, whatever. Those expressions become the way you you deal with the impressions in your life. And it's a way of blowing off steam and kind of understanding what it is to live in a very complicated world.
We'd just like to get into sort of some of the things that you've learned over your career so far. Obviously, the film industry is a very nebulous thing where it's difficult to understand how things really work when you're standing on the outside. Mm-hmm. What were there any misconceptions that you had going in that were corrected after a few years working in there? Or was there anything that you never even thought of that ended up being a huge factor that that determines success?
The industry itself is probably like any industry where it involves a lot of human beings. It's chaotic. It's full of outsized egos and narcissists and the good and the bad of humanity. And I don't think that's unique to the movie business. I think it's maybe exaggerated and accentuated in the movie business, but it's certainly not unique to the movie business. The one thing, though, I keep coming across is the people that have been successful over a long term and the people who have staying power, whether as writers or cinematographers or whatever, they tend to be pretty authentic good guys and girls. The screamers, the people that throw their cell phones, tend not to last too long, but they get the headlines. I think the really interesting creative people are the ones that have their head down and are trying hard to create something special on the screen. And those are just wonderful people who have found a way over decades to express their art and do it in a way that's not only humane but collaborative with other people. We all have our good and bad days. We all have our screaming days. We all have our cell phone throwing days. But by and large, the people that last in the industry are pretty good, pretty approachable. You know, pretty willing to listen, pretty willing to help students come up. And I think that's hopeful. And the other people that aren't that way, that are just I'll use the term idiots for lack of a better word. You can stay away from them. You know, you don't have to hang out with them. You don't have to work with them. Those people exist in every industry, and you'll know them when you see them, and you'll know their mediocrity by what work they do. And there's a lot of people in Hollywood that are really good at having lunch, and that's fine. I think the more interesting people in Hollywood or any creative industry are the ones that are really good at their work, and those are the people I want to hang out with.
If you could go back and talk to your 20-year-old self, is there any advice you would give to you?
I would just want to say don't gain so much weight in your 40s. but aside from that, No, not necessarily. I think I probably at a few too many ways along the lines didn't speak up or was a little quiet about my asking for things and not asking for raises and stuff. That was never a factor as much as asking for opportunities or saying, you know, if there's an opportunity here, I would be interested in doing this or that. My ears were always open. I was always excited when opportunities came along. So I would always work off of the assumption that if I worked hard and did good work with other people, people would take notice. And that's been true in my life. So I would probably be a little more confident in my abilities. I'd be a little more self-confident and not so self-critical. I was really self-critical when I was younger, and I still am, but I try not to be so much anymore. So to just believe in yourself as something worthwhile, somebody who has a worthwhile story to tell. And I think that's probably the advice I would give.
Looking at some of the changes that have happened in the industry over the past several years, is there any advice you would give to a 20-year-old entering the business now?
Yeah, you know, some wonderful things are happening in the movie business that change it profoundly. For example, 20 years ago, you would say, well, if you want to work in television, you have to work for ABC, NBC, CBS, or maybe Fox. So those are your four networks. You work there or you don't work at all. Now those four networks are almost irrelevant. They're not, but they've been eclipsed by Amazon, Netflix, Google. So those are the new networks. Those are the people that are forming pipelines and creative alliances for a level of creativity that we haven't seen before. And you used to have to wait for the phone to ring. And if you got a phone call from Paramount or Warner Brothers or Disney, it would make your life. And you'd get a job on a movie. It'd be fantastic. Don't wait for a phone call. That's my advice. Don't wait for the phone to ring. If you're a director, grab a camera and go out and start making movies. Make shorts. Make the people I know in their 20s who are succeeding already at a young age and getting their films into festivals, they're out making movies. And if they don't have the money, they're making movies with their cell phones, and they're writing their own music, and they're working with friends and collaborating with friends who write and shoot and can act and making movies. So it's not about waiting for a studio to call. It's not about waiting for somebody to sign you up to a 3-picture deal anymore. That's gone. It's not going. It's gone. So now it's really about creative individuals and ideas, and there's more hunger for creative ideas than ever before. The planet's got a pipeline to every person out there on their cell phone, and the idea that we can watch creative content anytime we want, anywhere we want, is profoundly different from what it was a few years ago when you had to buy a ticket to a movie. That is such an old idea. So now it's, you want to see a movie? You have 5 choices for how to see that movie: in your home theater, on your cell phone, on your watch, in a movie theater. And that's a good thing for creative people. So if you're a young filmmaker starting out, make films. If you're a young actor starting out, act in any opportunity, anywhere, for money if you can. But if it's not for money and you trust the collaborators, if they're not idiots trying to do something, if you trust them and trust their work, work for free. You know, that's okay. I do it all the time. I do it now. If I see a project I like and I want to jump in on it, you don't have to make a deal. You just jump in on it. Sometimes money stops us in our tracks. We say, well, I'm not going to work on that unless I get $100,000. Well, good luck then. You're not going to work on that. So jump in with your heart into places that you trust, with people that you trust, but actually get out and do it. And that's a really big change. And I think the people that will succeed in the coming years are ones that recognize that and realize that not only can you make and shoot and edit and put music on your own movies, but you have distribution channels that I never had when I was coming up. You can put your movies on Vimeo. You can put them on, you can release them on any number of outlets, and you can advertise them, and people will see your movies. Well, that wasn't the case 20 years ago, and it's the case now. So it's an incredibly exciting time for young filmmakers coming up. You just have to do it. And that's the thing, that there's going to be many amateurs out there that don't do it or do it for a little bit and give up. And the ones that will succeed are the ones that are just like, I'm a filmmaker. I'm going to start making films. And they stick to it. And that'll be the difference between the success and the amateurs of the future.
You mentioned in Brainstorm how access is everything, basically. And is there any advice you'd have for people who are maybe like Zach and myself, stuck up in Canada, not able to work in the States right out of right out of film school. Is there any advice you'd have to them, or any ways that they can gain the kind of access to be able to build a career as, say, a producer?
Well, it's easy to get access to information now. So you have access to great teachers and great instructors and great online classes to talk about storytelling and filmmaking. So the access to one-way information coming into your brain is pretty easy now, especially if you can afford to pay for some classes online or whatever. The access to individuals who might be able to help you, particularly in financing, is just a matter of reaching out and trying to develop those relationships with any number of people. And everybody does that. Steven Spielberg does it. Everybody does it. You have to find out whether it's going to be a Kickstarter program or a relative or a combination of those things. And most everybody nowadays relies on a bunch of financial support, not just from one source. If you're making a film from Disney, that's great. Disney writes a big check and you make that film. But by and large, most movies are made with a consortium of investors. So if you're starting out and want to make films on your cell phone that are going to cost a couple thousand dollars, that's a lot easier. Film festivals are a great way to get your work seen out there, and then go to the festival. And I've met so many interesting filmmakers at festivals. I've developed relationship with those filmmakers, and I've actually made films with those filmmakers that I've met at festivals. So festivals are a terrific place to meet people and get access to each other and support each other as a filmmaker. And that's the biggest thing. And then if you get to the point where you're successful enough and you have really good work to show, you can start showing it to places like agencies. And agencies can be good, but you don't need to. You don't need an agent. If you have one, agencies are great in terms of making connections, and they can say, you know, Don, I'd like you to meet 20 of our clients, and here's 20 clients. Go out and have meetings with them, and you might come up with some really interesting ideas. That's a cool thing. You don't want to turn your back on that. But you can do some of that yourself. So there's no rules anymore the way there might have been 25, 30 years ago. And you can carve your own path with or without an agent. You can make your own movies with or without a studio. And the biggest thing is in the doing of it. It takes resourcefulness. It takes a lot of energy to do that. I'm not trying to make it sound easy. And there's a lot of barriers in place to keep the amateurs out. Studios won't answer your phone calls. People won't return your call. There'll be a lot of barriers put up, but those are there to keep the amateurs out. And you got to feel like, well, okay, I'm just going to go over those barriers and take them one at a time and weed through them, and eventually I'll get through to the people I need to talk to.
Is there a best or worst piece of advice that you've ever received?
Yes, and then I also have to call time here pretty soon, guys, because I have to run to another meeting. I think the best advice really is the persistence of it all. Persistence meaning there's too many ways to give up or throw your hands up along the way, and persistence and coming back and getting up again and trying new things is really the key to so much of success in anything, you know, in the arts, in figure skating, in anything. So getting up and getting back in the game is really important. And the worst advice tends to be dogmatic advice, advice that's black and white, advice that says you can't, as an actor, you can't begin to do anything unless you have an agent. Well, I just don't believe in that anymore. Look at how many people are celebrities because, you know, from Justin Bieber to whoever, because they put their work on the internet, because they're songwriters and they start to post things on YouTube. There's an outlet there that maybe wasn't there before. So there's ways of getting your work out there that weren't there before. So somebody that comes up to you and says, listen, here's what you have to do. You have to apply here, and you have to turn in this kind of thing, and you have to show 20 examples. Those kind of black and white examples of what to do, I would always question. They may be right, but I always question those things and say, okay, really? So I have to apply here. Why do I have to apply here? Who should I talk to? And be inquisitive about those things and find out what you really have to do to make those things work. And then just, you know, don't give up, persist.
Just as sort of a final question here, if there was one idea that you could pass on, one thing that you've learned, or one thing that you've come to realize is true, what is that idea? What would that be if you could only teach one thing to people?
I would say be authentic to yourself. I would say the job that you're after in life isn't a job as a cameraman or a director or a screenwriter or a grip. The job you want to pursue is the job of being the best you that you can be. And that may sound easy and dismissive, but it's not at all. It's trying to figure out the complexities of who you are, where you came from, what your hometown is, what your family was like, and then finding out what kind of stories you have to tell and being authentic to that. So that's the job. And you might do that as a cameraman or as a producer, and you might do that as a accountant or a real estate developer. There's a number of ways to do that. The opposite side of that is living life in a reactive way to what other people want. You know, my spouse wants me to be this, or my Alan Menken, the great songwriter who wrote Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast, his family is full of dentists, and his family wanted him to be a dentist growing up. And he said, no, inside out, I'm a songwriter, and they thought he was crazy. So you have to just evaluate yourself and say, this is who I am, and this is who I think I can be from the inside out, not from the outside in, and try to live a deliberate life in that way and try to find out who you are and be the best you that you can be, as opposed to just reacting to other people and say, oh, my mom wants me to be this, my dad wants me to be this, my girlfriend wants me to do this, my boyfriend wants me to do this, and I don't know, so I'm just going to kind of stumble through life and take opportunities, but never have a deliberate point of view about who I am. So I think that's the key. I think that's a big key anyway. And that can change. The person you are at 20 years old is not the person you're going to be at 25 or 30. So it's not a set in stone thing, but you have to stop once in a while and say, I am this kind of person. I love these things. I hate these things. I'm lazy. I'm productive here. I don't want to do this. I do want to do that. And kind of define who you are and then start to act on that in a more deliberate way than most of us do.
Yeah. Don, we really appreciate you joining us today.
You're really welcome. You're really welcome. I hope it's been good for you.
We're looking forward to your new documentary. Hopefully you write another book sometime in the near future that we'd love to read.
Yeah.
And we just can't thank you enough for your time and your advice, Don.
Yeah,
it's
really.
My pleasure,
thank you.
Guys. Thanks for the great questions. I really appreciate it.
All right. Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Take care. Hey, guys. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you had fun. You know, Don's a really cool guy. And if you want to check out some more of his work, there's one particular film of his that I highly recommend. It's called Waking Sleeping Beauty. Now, this is a documentary. And in it, Don takes us behind the scenes of the complete renaissance that Disney had in their feature animation department from the mid-80s and in on through to around the mid-90s. And, they've never really looked back. So, you know, starting back in the mid-80s. And keep in mind, Don was there for this. He lived it, so he takes us behind the scenes like no other person can. Again, it's called Waking Sleeping Beauty, and I've linked to it down below. If you want to check out any more of his work or any of his books, you can find the links to all of those and more on our website at theproducerscut.com. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you had fun, and I hope to see you in the next episode. Take care.